welcome to Debt Protection People's podcast, Debt Protection Made Easy. I'm joined this afternoon by our very growing star, Jasmine. I'm also joined by Phil Brining, and our producer, Miles, is listening in just to keep us all policed and in check. But welcome, the three of you.
Hello.
Thank you. Yes, thank you.
It was a really interesting session. It's a GDPR radio series with a very little bit of news at the end, possibly. I mean, if I possibly even any news, a really interesting debate that's we'd like you to listen to the end. And if you've got thoughts and feelings on it, do please let us know. We'll get on to that shortly. But the bulk of the session was about SARS, wasn't it? We there was a question came up that we responded to in the chat, and it kind of took off from that point, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was a great session. There's a lot of people and there was tons of interaction, a lot of people muting and that. I mean, we started off talking about interviews, didn't we, and the calibre of candidates and the difficulty of finding, you know, good quality people. I didn't ask you, I meant to ask you, did you use our competency matrices that you've developed? But because again, I that's the sort of thing that we maybe should be sharing with the community, the DPO competency matrices and a progression from data protection apprentice right up to a senior consultant. Again, but I think people might be interested in seeing that type of stuff. So we talked about it to start with, didn't we? And then somehow we got, oh, I know, because we got a question raised and we got onto the subject of SARS. And that ran off with itself, didn't it, Jasmine? But that's what we're talking about next week. So I was trying to put the brakes on it, thinking we're stealing our thunder for next week. But wow, that was a great debate and discussion, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we just entered a rabbit hole, to be honest, as you can with most things data protection. But it, you know, the questions just kept flowing, people kept stepping into it to give their thoughts. So yeah, it was really, really interesting. A lot of interesting topics discussed and concepts.
We tried to pick out the chat, didn't we, and talk about it, because if you listen to this you don't see the chat, but there was a lot of chat, a lot of comments, a lot of thumbs up, a lot of smiles. It was a brilliant session, I thought, in terms of the way people were engaging with it.
There's so much chat going on at times, it's hard to actually try to keep on top of what's saying, and there's probably some really, really valuable comments that we weren't able to kind of raise and bring to life in the session, because at one point it was just getting so busy with people sometimes trying to jump in and talk.
You don't want to back up the discussion again, because it's progressed. Yeah.
Oh, scared that it might go down another rabbit hole. We'll end up going down another warren somewhere. So it's trying to kind of keep it in check. So if anybody is listening back and you did raise a comment and we didn't cover it, it's because sometimes there's just so many we never get around to them. But we do appreciate all the comments that are in there. But it's a very, very busy session. Do you want to introduce just briefly the point at the end, this kind of debate that's been going around in the office, and to see whether it's
I'll try to, Dave. But the more I keep losing my thread on it. But so the final 10 minutes we talked about the new PECA guidance, or one aspect of the new PECA guidance. We moaned a few weeks ago about it not being clear what had changed in the guidance, because there's no kind of change history on the ICO's website on the guidance. But good old Vicky found something because she was researching something for a client, and it all relates to communications via electronic means on the LinkedIn platform or social media platforms, and whether that's B2B communications or B2C communications, and whether it's marketing or not. So the discussion was about that, and it's again well worth listening to, because we've got five consultants in the business, and we've got six actually, and we've kicked it around. We've all taken a slightly different take on it, because the guidance I think it's quite ambiguous. Think it's very ambiguous? Yeah. Joe thinks it's pretty clear, so you know. But it just kind of leaves these communications, it says, are not B2B marketing, and it leaves it at that. So well, what are they then? You know, are they B2C marketing? Are they not marketing at all? And that's a great discussion to have. You know, we had a real just scratch the surface of it, but I'd be interested. Hopefully next week, if people have thought about it, hopefully they'll come back in with a load of their own views.
Maybe start next week with that session, just before we get onto sales, before we run away. Has anybody thought about this point, and can we discuss it a little bit further in that sense? But do listen through, do get to the end. But and if you've got a strong opinion on it, do reach out to producer Miles, as always. Drop your thoughts and feelings to Miles about the session, about any questions that are raised, whether you want to join in yourself, whether there's topics and bits that you're not sure about, whether you want to introduce your colleagues, your friends to the session. It's a growing community of people like ourselves that love to talk about these things on a regular basis, and we do need producer Miles as a policeman to make sure that we're all in line and in check. But that's we'd best just finish there for today before we jump into the
Yes, except session. To say that this is, sadly, this is your last session with us because you're moving on to new pastures. And I said on the thing, and I'll say it here again, you've been a most excellent colleague, and I will very much miss your counsel.
And thank you very much. And I've got the, I might as well just say it so it's recorded. I've got the utmost respect for DPP and Phil and his knowledge. I think anybody who's looking for a role, do look at DPP, because it'll certainly broaden your knowledge, your experiences, and your opportunities from gleaning and learning from Phil.
Now let's move on then. Now let's go. So enjoy the session.
Miles can edit that bit out if you like.
No, I think it goes the same as well. While you might not be a host of the shows anymore, the soapbox will appear again. We'll make sure of it.
I'll come back. I'll let Miles have my details, and I'll certainly be back. But let's leave it there for today. Let's let the audience jump into the sessions and enjoy the sessions as usual. So thank you very much for taking part in the community, for being part of the community. As I always try to say, we wouldn't be here if it wasn't for people like yourselves regularly listening in and giving us topics to talk about. So please do continue to do so. From now, though, have a great weekend. Enjoy the podcast, and we'll speak to you soon.
Thank you, and enjoy the session.
Now, what sort of week have you had, Dave? Have you been busy, or have you been deck chairing it with your feet up last week?
The boss is here, so I've been busy. it's been a good week, actually. I've been trying to look at handovers with clients. I've been involved with some training, been involved with some quite interesting emails and queries. I'm sure we'll maybe discuss one or two of them on the session shortly. I've also been involved with supporting a client through recruitment. So I've been taking part in interviewing individuals that were applying for DPO roles and stress testing their knowledge a little bit to see whether they're recruitment worthy. So a busy, busy week.
Very good. I've also had an extremely busy week as well. Have you, Jasmine?
Yes. It seems to be going on these days. But
yeah. I've heard you described as the new Ollie, Jasmine. Is this true?
I suppose so. It's big boots to fill, but I'll give it a shot.
So, Dave, the interview candidates, what's the overall, standard? Was it very good? I mean, was this a short list or a long list? Or
we went through a short listing and identified about five people, possibly six people that were that we thought was worth interviewing based on the scoring and the criteria for putting them forwards. Unfortunately, a couple of them removed their ability and withdrew their application, should say, might be a better way of saying it, withdrew their application. So it kind of narrowed it down a bit. There's some on paper what looked really, really good candidates. In that sense, but when you're stress testing some of the knowledge, it was just a shame. And I don't know whether it's possibly just interview nerves, possibly, or whether it's a lack of varied experiences and so on and so forth. But some of them weren't able to kind of really bring their experience and their knowledge to life. There's kind of the general statements around data protection. We were asking them, for example, around DPIAs, and they kind of told you what the DPIA was, not necessarily delved into some of the details and some of the problems, and kind of brought it to life with examples where DPIAs went wrong, that kind of thing, or that there's other issues with trying to take a collaborative approach to DPIAs, for example, that kind of thing. So I was really kind of missing some of that really, really good detail and that really kind of granular level explanations around some of the questions to kind of represent that they've got a good understanding of the topic or the part that they're talking about. So there was, there was an individual that was able to do that and did that particularly well. But unfortunately, the other two were very likable. But unfortunately, I just didn't necessarily bring to life their experiences as well.
Oh, what level were you recruiting at? Again, I'm interested to hear anybody else, because we're recruiting for consultants, as you know, and we're also finding a mixed bag and not much depth of experience. So what level, and other people on the call might also, I'm just interested, is it a state of the nation type of thing of the industry? What level were you recruiting at?
They were recruiting to the DPO, or a DPO role. The salary band was 55K. They wanted demonstrable experience of working in data protection, as you would do at that kind of salary band, and kind of requisite qualifications. And I'm not, the next statement I'm going to say is not necessarily aimed at anybody who we're interviewing, but from our own internal recruitment, when I've been looking at CVs and stuff, sometimes you get the impression that it's some individuals have got all the gear but no idea kind of approach. They've got the qualifications, but they don't necessarily know how to practically apply that in that sense. And that's the element I'm really kind of missing, because at the end of the day, if you're paying a higher salary, you want somebody to be able to bring it all to life, be able to explain the nuances within it, some of the difficulties they've had, how they've got past the difficulties, and then how they brought the matter to a reasonable solution or understanding in that sense. And a lot of the explanations that I've seen when we try to stress test people on the knowledge is just kind of a basic explanation of the law. So I'm not necessarily saying they've not got any knowledge, but for the level that they're trying to attain to, I'm not quite sure it's necessarily there. Maybe they've not had the bandwidth or the experience of working with various different clients over different sectors, over different needs, and it's quite narrow experience and that kind of stuff. And it just leaves you with that little bit of doubt as to whether that was just my interpretation and they didn't sell themselves properly when they had the chance to kind of really shine at an interview stage, or whether actually anecdotally that there is a lot of reasonable people out there doing reasonable jobs, but when you're looking for the higher level jobs, just the ability to kind of really explain the nuances and bring it to life and understand some of the difficulties, I've often found not necessarily heavily evidential.
Yeah, and did you appoint?
There was a recommendation to appoint. Obviously, I don't work for the company, so I can't say you must appoint. It was only recommending that you may want to consider their appointments in that sense. The appointment was a recommendation that you might want to go ahead with the recruitment, but they may need additional support just with some of the nuances, just with some of the areas that they may struggle with, that kind of thing.
Yeah, all right, okay. I don't know if anybody else has had any similar kind of recruitment experiences. We find the same, as you know, Dave, that there's a lot of applicants, particularly if you advertise on Indeed. We've started advertising on LinkedIn now. We've got much better caliber of applicants, but it's a whole mixed bag, and trying to read a CV and determine if there is actually practical experience is quite hard. You can only find that by being towards people, but you only find out actually once you've got them sat across a desk. I mean, you're working on a problem together.
For sure.
Mrs. Lane, would you like to step in?
I'm a data protection officer, and sort of was parachuted into the role in 2018. So I've been learning on the ground, if you like, and I always worry about my own knowledge and the grasp of the whole concept. But last year I was deployed, I work in the school sector, I was deployed to another school. I do business manager kind of role as well, and they needed some support, so I was moved to a school outside of our network to support them, and they had a subject access request while I was there. The school bought into a DPO service, so I had to engage with the service thinking I would learn stacks from them. And I actually thought, well, my knowledge is not that bad, actually, if this is the advice that's forthcoming. So that surprised me, really. And so just linking to what you say, it's a mixed bag out there at the minute, I think.
Definitely.
And I think I'd have passed your interview.
I think you get both sides of it, don't you? You get the people who have that understanding but don't know how to apply it, and then the people that are thrown into the role and have to just learn as you go along and hope that you swim, don't sink.
So. Yeah, I also think in the defence of some individuals as well, that the data protection is just not their sole focus. So in the role that we do as consultants, it's our sole focus. So we'd expect to have a deeper knowledge and broader experiences and things. But where an individual might have been thrown into, oh, by the way, data protection is your responsibility alongside doing A, B, C and D as well, and they've maybe not got the time to focus on it in the same way. And maybe possibly looking at myself, I've maybe got too higher expectations of individuals in that sense. But you can imagine that where you've they've got a multiple role in wearing multiple hats, but they've maybe not got the ability to solely focus on a range of matters, possibly not just within their sector, but the broad reading, like we do on these sessions where you pull apart some ICR guidance or some case law or some things that happened in the news, and whether that's just tempered it slightly. And it's more of a resourcing issue around the role and providing them with appropriate tools, knowledge and experiences to support them with that, not necessarily directly down to their quality, shall we say.
I think you probably have got extremely high expectations, as I do. No, that's a compliment, Dave. Because you expect people to have, I'm afraid I'm guilty of this, you expect people to have the same level of understanding and degree of and depth of understanding, and that's not necessarily right. Interesting that Mrs. Lane's, you know, engaged with the DPO service and found that actually she probably knew as much, if not more, than they did. Again, that's you know, not great.
Sure.
But we keep saying, you know, the part of the reason we do these, you know, we meet a lot of great people doing this, and it's about building a network. You know, this, a lot of this stuff, and we can move on to this in a minute when we're talking about some ICO guidance, which is absolutely just classic ICO guidance. You know, you read the guidance, you read the law, and you find yourself in that grey area, that ambiguous area that doesn't quite seem to meet the case that the ICO is using in their guidance. And therefore, you need confidence, you know, that you're right and that you're working about it in the right way. And what's interesting about this ICO guidance is that we had a big debate about it in the office here. We've all got a slightly different point of view and different interpretation. We're going to talk about that because I think it'd be quite interesting. And we say quite often to people, you know, use the network around you. You know, free advice from people, you know, on here, in other schools, in other sectors, because everyone's got a slightly different opinion. And what we haven't got, really, we haven't even really got it either, is time to read around the subject. You know, we're all really time poor, aren't we? And nobody's got time to go and read everything. There's such a lot of material out there. Anyway, I don't know where I was going with that discussion, but interesting.
For sure. And I know with just in the chat as well, that Shane said that if it's a DPO role and the legislation is clear, there should be no activities that detract from performing the role, which is correctly what the law says. But there's difference sometimes before what the law says and what actually happens in practice, unfortunately. But there's this.
I thought the law said that the DPO could have other duties provided they didn't provide a conflict of interest.
Yeah, so there wasn't a conflict of interest and not detract. So if you're looking at detracting from performing from your role, is that a conflict of interest because your focus then isn't on data protection in that sense? So I get that. But the main point I was trying to drive there is it's OK what the law says in as law. And we do try to look for compliance around those areas. But as we see many times with clients and with organisations where they've got multiple competing elements going on, it's not always necessarily easy to follow the straight line of the law and ignore everything else that's going on from a practical or a commercial point. And it's trying to make your best endeavours to meet all competing interests, isn't it?
Lauren's comment's interesting as well about, you know, a lot of small organisations, and this is the same. My wife, as I've said before on here, is a school bursar, but she works in very small rural primary schools in North Yorkshire. She works for the council and they provide a financial service. And you know, the schools have got 10 children in it, you know, like three teachers and 10 children in some cases, which is like nuts. But you know, how on earth have they got the resources to, you know, be on top of everything in the school and then other stuff like data protection as well? Well, there's no chance, and it's a complicated area, you know, which is why we love it. It's a complicated area. Lost my train of thought now. It was the garage phoning about a car that going for MOT. So yeah, absolutely got a lot of empathy and sympathy with you, Lauren, there. But again, you can use, you know, ideally use networks that are around you, you know, lean on other people, you know, maybe as a bunch of schools in a particular area, you know, try and do something. I mean, Vicky, our consultant, is nodding here saying she's just come out of the education sector to join us as a consultant. You're saying yes, get a network built, aren't you?
Maybe we could bring Vicky on because she's trying to develop a network for the education sector, aren't you, on LinkedIn. So maybe we could ask Vicky to unmute if she's listening and wants to jump in for 2 seconds just to explain that. But I think it's vitally important because Joe's also highlighted that as a DPO in further education, you don't have much opportunity to have conversations with other people, and it can be awfully lonely in house at times when you're looking for those points to bounce off, and you're looking for possibly you may be even getting challenged, or you're not clear, or you are clear, but you're getting so much challenge you're not quite sure if you're actually right in that sense. And just having those points of call, they build a kind of a community for yourself, join communities like this one, that kind of thing, where you've got the freedom to ask questions and the support of everybody else to work through what those issues are. And that kind of thing, and to use the resources that are available to you, because like I say, it can be awfully difficult and lonely in some places.
Yeah, definitely. I think a lot of it comes down to confidence as well. You know, people will have the know-how, but because it's such, you know, data protection in general, such a grey area, you sometimes never 100% sure. And then just bouncing it off someone, you know, sometimes clients will call us.
Sometimes.
Well, no, let me finish. They'll call us and just, you know, they'll ask us a question, but and you won't even end up saying anything because they're just bouncing it off you. You know, they'll come to the conclusion through having someone to talk to. It's it's that's all you need sometimes. But it's, I think people, even with our DPO training course, you know, people have been using that as the extra confidence, realizing that they do know a lot of information, but it's just having that confirmed, because it's tricky.
Yeah, well, that's one of our main aims, isn't it?
As you go along, so.
Yeah, one of the main aims of the course is to try and give people confidence to make decisions. But anyway, sorry, Dave, you were going to say.
Yeah, no, I was just going to support what Jasmine said there. From delivering some of the training, not just from the DPO's training, but other training we delivered over the years and things, getting the feedback from attendees and candidates on the courses and things, when they explain that, well, actually, the course is really useful because it's confirmed I do know what I'm thinking in that sense. So it's sometimes really great to get those kind of bits of feedback.
Yeah. But the less you do of this, the more you forget about it as well. So again, if you're doing this part-time because you're in a sort of general compliance role, and part of data protection is only a part-time function, you know, one, you are probably, because I do, you're going to forget stuff, and two, things move on. You know, as we're going to talk about the ICO guidance, you know, you don't know what you don't know, and if it all changes you know, so we do recognize that people who are doing it part-time have got an uphill challenge, really, in a for complicated sure. area
for sure. So that was that was kind of part of my week, looking at the training and delving ins and outs of what the training was, and it's, I find it really useful to kind of listen and to be in listening mode at times with candidates and try to, because it's easy to kind of assume everybody understands what we're talking about. It's easy when you're working it day in, day out, to have concepts and thoughts and feelings about some of the areas of data protection, and then just to assume or kind of imagine that everybody else has got a similar base level of understanding. So sometimes from a training point and working amongst a team, it's just trying to be in listening mode as well, and to try and identify some of those key points that may help to support individuals with their own learning. So that's that was really, really useful. It's just trying to keep my eye on the chat. I do apologize, Jasmine. I should try and keep my eye on the chat a little bit more as well. But Mrs. Lane's coming again, thank you. And as said, often real life doesn't match the tech books models, so it's just moved. So there's lots of reading, networking, to be confident in your handling of situation. Some of the confidence will come in time. I appreciate where you come from with that, Mrs. Lane, but it will come in time. Some of the gray areas, sometimes it's just trying to keep on top of bits and pieces. It changed, like you said, there's a lot to keep on top of, and sometimes certain areas of law changes far more quickly than others, and it's easy to miss parts in times as well. So that's why it's useful to take part in or to join kind of communities like ours, just to help try and keep on top of some of those areas.
Yeah, we've got a question from Mrs. Lane in the chat as well. I've been caught out this week. I believe sharing professional emails is okay, but now I've read if names used, for example, J Lane app, then these shouldn't be shared. Does everyone else agree? Do you want to give a little bit more context on that, Mrs. Lane, if you want to unmute again?
Yeah, so as I said, I was always of the opinion if something's used in a professional capacity, so school teachers, Jenny Lane, teacher or whatever, that's okay. So if you had a subject access request, I wouldn't strip out a teacher's name in an email if it had gone out, or if the email was referencing a pupil for example, I wouldn't strip that out because that teacher's name has been used in professional capacity, head of history or whatever. I'd let that go. And I believe the same was stood for email. So if I sent out an email to several schools and external bodies, but I was using my colleague's work email, so Jaylane at and whoever else, that's fine. But I've read something this week that makes me think if the organisation use your name in your email, so Jaylane at, that you shouldn't be sharing those. They should all be blind copied in an email.
A very interesting point, and I think before we jump in, there's a couple of other hands up. I'm just interested to see whether Pippa or just trying to see who else has got the hand up. Andrew, whether you're looking at jumping in to answer that one on our behalf, or whether you've got something to add. So we'll just come to those who's got the hands up first.
I think it depends, to be honest, because I work in healthcare, so I work in an ICB. And if we all take example as my email address is pippa.bolton2@nhs.net, but pippa.bolton's my personal data. Just because it's used in my work email doesn't mean. So what we tend to do, or what I do encourage with ours, is we look for consent to be used when we have to use it en masse, unless it's for part of our contract of employment, i.e. employment, HR. But also it's understanding with regard to healthcare, so the nhs.net, the tenancy, is my email address is going to follow me through my career, or should follow me through my career, so it goes to different organisations. But when it comes to a SAR, if my name's been used and I've sent an email to a pupil or a parent, then that parent will have already seen my details, so I wouldn't redact my name or that person's name. It all depends on the context, I think.
For sure. And let's just bring Andrew in there as well, just see if Andrew's looking at adding anything to that before we just pop back to Mrs. Lane.
Hi, yeah, I work local authority environment, and this brings all sorts of different issues to the fore. The context is vital. So whilst we would encourage people not to send out mass distributions on open copy, send it as blind copy, if we were looking at an SAR, the ICO has an unwritten concept of private personal and public personal. So if you're in that public role, your personal detail is less private than information about you in your personal life. And so depending on the context, one would probably leave professionals' identities and emails in if it is appropriate, but you can't do a black and white hard rule for either. You need to look at the context.
Yeah, so when fulfilling a SAR, when it comes to third party information, you know, you can, thank you both, by the way, you can withhold third party information unless it's reasonable to disclose, or you've got consent from the data, from the, you know, the data subject third party. So I think it does depend on the context of, as you've both said, you know, if it would be reasonable to disclose or not. But there are also some situations where someone acting in their professional capacity, such as a social worker, their role should, you know, within where they're acting within their role, that information should be disclosed as well. Phil and Dave, do you have any more comments on that?
Mrs. Lane's got her hand back up, so do you want her to come back in there, or
yeah. Yes, please. So, yeah, I bet with regards to the SAR, where you mentioned social workers, I thought teachers was in that kind of group that they should be. You didn't need to withhold that. I'd perhaps think again, though, about whether I shared staff emails within a SAR. I'd rethink the whole thing. But the thing that triggered it this week was not something that happened in our institution, but it was from an outside public body that emailed hundreds, I think, of CEOs, head teachers, and all with their professional email, but a number of them were up in arms that it had been an open email rather than a blind copy, so they could all see each other's professional emails. And when I first heard about it, I thought, well, there's a professional emails, you know, you Joe blogs at whatever school or trust, that's in a professional capacity. But I'm questioning it now. as to whether that was a breach or not.
There's been great comments in the chat, aren't there? All of which I think have got either, you know, a lot of merit. So there is this concept of reasonableness to disclose personal data relating to social workers, health workers, education workers in certain circumstances in SR. You know, so that what you mentioned, Jasmine, that third party, you know, the rights of third parties are kind of overruled in some cases by those rights of the assumption of reasonableness. I think Ben's point about the seniority of staff is also highly relevant. So, you know, the more senior you get, the less right effectively to a private, public, personal life you have. I think that's the same with the disclosure of salary bands and all sorts of things in the public sector.
But there have been people who have received that email, though, that maybe were DV victims, and then it's gone back to the perpetrator, anything in that scenario. So that's what I'd be worried about there with the Mrs. Lane scenario.
Yeah. But I think with all these things, the context is king. And that's back to the point we were making earlier. You know, we are sat in our potential ivory tower, you know, trying to pick our way through what we think is right, and sometimes we haven't got full information, and our colleagues are looking to us to try and get the call right, and the kind of the erring on the side of caution, which is what Maria is suggesting. Again, I would say, yeah, absolutely, if in doubt, take it out, because if you think of the process, you know, somebody might complain that they've overreacted their SAR, in which case they'd complain to the ICO, and the ICO would have a look at it, and the ICO might say, you've been overzealous in your redaction, you have to release this data. But that's probably the extent of it. And I think that my view, and we've done this on a number of occasions with clients. In fact, we're doing one now with a FOIA request we're looking at, where we're saying, you know, if you're not sure, take it out, because the worst case scenario is it gets called in, the ICO looks at it and says, bad decision. But that's it. You know, if, particularly if you can demonstrate that you've given it due consideration and you've, you know, got some rationale behind your decision making, as long as your decision making is not completely crass. There's lots of hands up, and then, and you haven't said anything, Dave, for a while.
No. I was just also I agree with most of the comments. I've got nothing really more to add than like you say, context and reasonableness, whether it's disclosed or whether it's withheld. And I think context is quite key in making that determination around reasonableness or not in that sense. But Ben's had his hand up for a while. I was just trying to find out. I've got a little icon down here that's got 80 plus with a hand up. And I was thinking, all 80 people surely can't be asking a question. So I was trying to find out who had the hand up. So Ben, I apologise, it's taken a while to find you. But Ben, if you'd like to come in.
That's right. I was just going to give my input, because I also work in further education, so similar field to Miss Lane. And when we do our subject access requests, as I put in the comments, if the data subject knows it's come from them, so there's an email conversation where it's been back and forth and they've been included, fair enough, no need to redact. If that individual is engaged in that day-to-day school life, so they know that that's their personal tutor, that's their lecturer, they hold that position just through that wider context of being in that school setting, no need to redact there because it's known to the data subject. But anything else, we err on that side of caution and we'll do those redactions. So if there are emails back and forth between members of staff, that would be a scenario where we'd look to redact unless it's reasonable or we have that consent. And often in the size of settings we are, a school, but particularly a college where we've got about 2,000 members of staff, the actual process of going through and getting consent from the various people involved in a 300 email correspondence, which might go off in SR, is just far too time consuming. So that's where redactions will often come into place. But I suppose it's that reassurance that things are being done correctly and you're having a similar thought process to others working in the sector, and that's the route we take.
For sure, and it's always interesting when you're looking at redactions as well, because if you're just simply redacting a name, that might not be sufficient to not make the person identifiable either. So when we're looking at redacting and kind of going, well, okay, we need to redact because of the context or the issue behind a particular comment or communication, that kind of thing. Well, how much more information outside of a name would you possibly have to remove in order to protect that person's right to confidentiality or not being identified as a source of that information, or so on and so forth? So if you were going to redact, it's not necessarily as simple as just taking a name out of a document. You could still be identified by something, even if your name was not on it, for example.
For us, we're looking at names, email addresses, email signatures, job titles. There's that full breadth of data, as you've led to.
Yeah, there's I guess a situation, say, you know, if there was an issue at work with between two employees and one employee gave a witness statement and it was obviously them that wrote that witness statement, then you can redact that information as well. So obviously where you can disclose third party information within professional capacity, if it's obvious that it came from them as the source, there is the exemption to withhold that information as well in different circumstances. And again, it depends on the context around it.
I mean, I love working with SARS because to me, the hardest thing is identifying, you know, what is personal data and then who it relates to. So you're quite right. And we've been looking at things for the last few years, and like the he said this or the neighbor did that. So when you're looking through, you know, when we're training our SAR Bureau people and the reviewers, and you can't just simply look for a name or an email address or a phone number or a national insurance number. You've got to look, as everyone keeps saying quite rightly, as a context. You know, the neighbour upstairs in the wheelchair, you know, isn't going to come up if you search for that person's name, but that is going to identify them. You know, and if the next stage was, you know, said that the person was smoking dope in the hallway of the you know, office block, or whatever, then all that is something that, you know, should be redacted. But you know, finding that in a massive information under pressure, time pressure, is a real skill. And what we had some really interesting ones in the past, and I'm looking at Vicky again. So in the education sector, you know, there's a tendency to use initials of teachers. It's probably still there was when I was at school. So we had a subject action request, and the initials of the teacher, I can't remember what they were, like AN or something. So the requester said, I want you to search for everything with, you know, Anna Naylor, whatever she's got, I can't remember what it's called, Anna Naylor, A Naylor, or AN. And we said, no, we're not going to search for that because that's manifestly unreasonable. But in order to, and we had the question come up a couple of weeks ago on the support desk. We said, you know, what you got to do is you got to quantify why it's unreasonable. So we did a search, or they did a search of the documentation, and found like a million references of AN because it's a standard word in the English language. So that was the basis of refusing to search on those terms. But again, you need to kind of build all I think a lot of this is building yourself a defensible position. You know, so if you do have, you know, things put under scrutiny, you know, how strong is your defensible position? Where is the documentation of your assumptions? Who have you spoken to? You know, and where have you got to, or how have you got to that conclusion? Another hand up.
That's how Vicky.
That's me.
Vicky's going to join us.
Oh, Vicky, sorry.
Yeah, no, that's me. I was just going to say, yeah, so in the case of that SAR, it was actually the initials of our head teacher. So we did the search and we pulled it up, but it was multiple million documents, and it was just unreasonable to go through all of those when actually the vast majority of it would have been the head teacher emailing, because her email address was an@the school. So it would have picked up every email that she'd ever sent or received, and it was impossible to do it. But under data protection law, they are entitled to receive their personal data, and if teachers were referring to the pupil as AN, then that is still their personal data. And as a result, we sent something out around staff saying that they shouldn't refer to pupils as initials anymore, and they should put first name, surname, and so it was easily searchable.
It's an opportunity to go back and, you know, look helpful. Can you narrow the scope? You know, that's got brought up 2 million search hits, etc., etc. So again, you can't just like, well, I don't think you can just like throw it back and say on your bike, you know, jog on. We got to try and help the requesters. But that was a really interesting case. There was something else we were going to say about that, but I have forgotten.
I wonder if you could use that with Boolean logic. So you've got initials and something else to try and refine it. Now, like and/ors and not statements. If your system's set up to do Boolean logic for your searches, so you could look and I'm looking for these initials and the word grievance and the word teacher and the word something or other to try you and narrow it down a little bit.
Probably could, but that requires a high degree of technical skill, I think.
I know.
And probably a decent search tool. And if you're just using Microsoft, you know, File Explorer, I think you got naff all chance.
Sorry, Michael, do you want to step in?
Yeah, there's some really good points everyone's bringing up. You know, I've worked for some councils and hospitals and private organizations, and recently private one, I'm not gonna name them right now, but one of the things that people have seen is they have adjusted, and I think it's bad habits, with things like you can apparently not even release the patient release information from people, their inboxes related to a SAR, if the person does not want you to, so they should probably be asked. But then you have challenges with that the person making the request is probably gonna be quite upset if they get nothing, because everybody is going to, but you know, limits have to be in place. Reading University has a software literally where they pull all the personal data and they don't put it in a nice format, it's just shoved all together, and anything that's not related to the patient is withdrawn, and they get it very quickly because they had so many at some point. And a lot of people are using different softwares, but checking in with the software to see if it's actually redacting or information is being withheld for things like FOI requests. I think Reading Council was doing that. That was the only way they could manage. I think they had a very bad reputation for managing them a long time ago. Sorry if anyone on the call is from there. But essentially, I think one of the things you must always consider is if the patient or person has received this information already, it's been CC'd to the communication and email trail, you could probably argue that they've already received the information. So yeah, you don't actually need to necessarily send it all out. Mm-hmm. So someone mentioned earlier about the person might be CC'd in some previous correspondence. So unless they are specifically asking for that email they've already received, then you might be giving them too much, and then you could probably reduce it. And going back to what you said about people giving everything that they can to someone about something is good, but it's all about that clarification. Like you said, if someone said to me, and I've had a few, can I have 7 departments worth of information from every single employee, all the emails related to me, all the messages and information from these different higher ups as well, that's too much, and that breaks the limit that you can set in place. You can't go to every individual person, take them from wards and other workplaces and say, could you give me all this information? Because some of it won't be related, but you're not going to have time to do all that. So being helpful always has a limit. So, yeah, that's my quick one piece.
I think there's some great points. I would say, just, you know, what we're like here, we like to kind of talk devil's advocate type of stuff. But you just have, I think, probably possibly be a little bit careful. You know, they've had that email, they still got it. So there was a Citibank, some or other case, wasn't there? She was a former employee though, and they refused to give her emails because they said, well, you know, you've already had them, and she won the court case. But if they've double deleted them, they haven't got access to them. So I know I'm nitpicking, but that's what we do. Yeah. That's what we do here. But
you would need to prove it.
I agree with
you?
It in principle.
So you probably say, oh, well, it's going to take too much time for me to go through 2,000 emails to find all the ones that were sent to you and take them away. And then you don't want to go to someone and say it's disproportionate, or they have to pay money to get the work done for you, because you want to find that one email. Like you say, isn't that haystack or something?
Yeah, we tend to take the view that if they've had it before, why would you bother to redact it? Why wouldn't you just give them it again, you know? Right or wrong.
You know, quite like.
If they've seen it, then why would they have you have a problem showing them it again?
I totally agree. Yeah. But it's just some people make it very difficult. I've gone to some businesses where they just haven't bought any software, they haven't got any digital staff, so they get 8 lawyers to redact only 7 emails, and somehow they end up with 800 pages worth of material, and then one piece of personal data is missed. And sometimes I think you have to understand, it doesn't matter about the people's qualifications sometimes. It's about like all the checking and the reviewing processes you have.
Yeah, yeah.
And then,
yeah,
like you said, like evidencing why you didn't release it. Because you could probably be
spot on
saying it's actually not limited by SARS, maybe it's national security or something else. And then you have to get legal involved to give like a letter or balance up, because, you know, you might be fined by the ISO for that one email, but actually might not be worth the damage it will cause, and they'll probably understand, to be honest.
I don't think I've seen a fine for ASAR at all, actually. I don't think it's something. I think they would fine you for refusing to, and they would possibly fine for, you know, a massive personal data breach through disclosing, you know, accidentally. But they haven't, as far as I'm aware, levied a fine for ASAR.
It's usually a nice slight message.
I'm not saying it's not there as a possible option. I've just never seen exercise as an option with the ICO. So and most of the ones I've seen challenged with the clients have always had the ICO kind of responding back, saying you need to kind of review what you've done and liaise with the data subject. And from our point, the case is closed, that kind of thing. So there doesn't seem to be that heavily kind of focused by the regulator on that.
They do that a lot. I mean, I've seen that a lot of times where they come back. So I've had this complaint about the way you've handled this SAR. We would ask you to have a look at it again. That's what they say, first step, and then usually it's kind of just disappeared off. I've seen that quite a few times, and I shouldn't say this, but you know, I know clients or customers, organizations have deliberately withheld information, but the building that defensive position is so important. If it looks like a great process, in my experience, the ICO will side with you as a controller. Andrew's got his hand up again.
I also find it quite funny that sometimes their emails begin with, do you feel like if you share this information, you'll be breaching legal privilege or the privacy of this data subject or something, when actually it's keenly about one email. So sometimes I think it's so cautious and it raises a lot of alarm bells. But I find a phone call usually works best. They usually tell you they only want to just check you're doing the right thing and just evidence it in an email, and that's it. You don't need to bring up 5,000 files and send it over.
They get
to.
They get quite fractious, don't they, SARs? You know, they feel like everyone's taking sides. Actually, you know, we're just trying to help someone get an understanding of something they want to try and find out about. I know that that's a simplistic way of looking at it, but they do get quite combative. Sorry, Andrew, you've been wanting to come in there.
So many things spilling out of that conversation. The last thing you said, Phil, about people realizing we're there to help them. I mean, that puts every DPO in the cleft stick of protecting and ensuring and governance of their own organization, but sometimes batting against them to uphold data subjects' rights. But I think sometimes we miss the point. Subject access is about data that relates to the applicant. So an email might not be anything about the applicant, just because they've been sent it. The only personal data in that email is their email address.
Yes, you're quite right. It's a good point.
And the other, we've never been challenged on it, and the ICO don't tend to rush to find people at first attempt. They say, well, why did you do this? And would you consider doing that? And you have that bit of ping pong. And if you get the impression that they're pressurizing you towards doing something without actually ordering it, you probably best listening at that point. But why would, I mean, in a council with millions of records, terabytes of the stuff, at first instance, we don't include emails to the applicant or from the applicant because we make the assumption they've got them, they've received them. If any were to come back and push, we would then go and find them. But we don't have a lot of people pushing back for the stuff that they know they've had and they know that they've sent. So in terms of our caseworkers, that massively reduces the amount of stuff that they have to go through. And the redaction tip, of course, is you've got a thread of 30 emails. Provided your applicant is the last person at the top of that thread, they can still have all the rest because they've had it once, they can have it again. So you're not breaching anybody anything if they've already got that entire thread, which the evidence shows they have because it's the complete thread and they're the last person to receive it. You don't really have to worry about the breaching of all those other people's identities because they've already got them.
So if you were to provide that information within the initial SAR, what would you do in a situation where an ex-employee who no longer has access to their inbox, you know, in terms of fulfilling that SAR, what would you do in that situation? Do you differentiate? Would you provide it then, or would you still
back to my first comment earlier on, context, context, context. There's always a contextual reason that might make you change from your general path of response. But, you know, I want all the emails I ever sent at work. That's not a subject access request. The subject access request is, this is your work email address. you know, you can't leave employment and say, I'd like to take all my business traffic with me. Mm-hmm. And I think the ICO would stand full shoulder square with us to say, that's not that individual's personal email. If they sent an email at work, it's not their personal data.
It still contains their personal information, though, doesn't it? And I think within emails...
What personal information does it... If I send you an email about something, it's not about me, it's about that something. The only personal data you have of me, and I have of you, is our email addresses. The content of that email is not the SAR.
I guess you can only tell that without
you're quite
looking.
Right.
Just chuck a grenade on the table. Okay, yeah. Every now and again, you need one, don't you? But it, you know.
Now we're in danger of stealing our own thunder, because actually next week is all about SARS. So I don't know if we'll have anything to talk about next week.
I'm on leave, Phil.
All good points, Andrew, and I agree with a lot of it. And that again, I think the trickiest thing. I want to come back to Dominique's question or point. As well, I think the key and the trickiest bit about SARS, as I said a minute ago, is, you know, identifying what is data. So you're quite right. If, you know, just because you're mentioned at the top of an email through your email address, if none of the content of the email relates to you, it is not personal data related to you. I hate the phrase my personal data or his personal or her, because I think, you know, the law is quite clear. It's information that relates to an identifiable person, which brings me back to kind of Dominic's point. It's not as much that the initials are personal data, it's that the initials are an identifier, and then anything else relating to that individual is the personal data. You know, so, you know, a timetable or a report, you know, if the report's signed off by their initials, is that the initials, yeah, okay, somebody, it's an identifier for somebody, and arguably it is low-level personal data in the right context, because outside of the school, it's meaningless. It's just a bunch of letters, isn't it? But it's just a way, when you're doing a sign, you're searching for stuff. You know, the customer requester says, you know, I want you to search for AN. It's just a way of finding data, you know, comments that they've made about, you know, the requester. It's what they're trying to find. And that might be all be hidden unless you're searching using initials. So, again, I think we're definitely going to get into a lot of this, hopefully next week.
But, I don't think the conversation's done here, to be honest. Could talk about it for hours, but it's probably worth moving on for the time being.
So next week's all about what is personal data in relation to a SAR. Because I agree with everything that you said, but it's fearing from doing a SAR part two session next week. I'm just trying to keep a swift eye on the time. I don't know whether there's any last comments about the SARS that anybody wants to raise, or whether we should kind of maybe move on to a new story just to get the GDPR of the podcast in.
I was going to throw another hand grenade in, right? So, but not about SARS. So if there's any further SARS comments, either dive in now or hold them till next week, unless, of course, you're Andrew and you're away. So I was going to make a suggestion again. Vicky and Dave might be going to dive in a second. So mentioned a few weeks ago that the ICO have updated their guidance on the PECA, and we moaned and groaned, or I moaned and groaned, that, you know, there's no change history, so you can't see what has changed. And the way that it's all done on web pages, it's very, very difficult to have, you know, any kind of comparison to what it was and what it now is. Anyway, Vicky, doing her digging about this week, has found something that I hadn't noticed in the new PECA guidance, and that's in relation to communications via social media, and particularly LinkedIn. So we had a case this week, and dive in if I'm paraphrasing this badly. We had a case this week where a customer wants to start doing marketing, or not, maybe reaching out to people on LinkedIn. So we thought, well, that's electronic communications, and therefore potentially caught by the PECA if it's unsolicited, direct, i.e. to one person, and marketing and electronic messaging, it's caught by the PECA. Oh, hang on, no, it's not, because LinkedIn is a business to business platform, and therefore you don't need prior consent. Yeah. The digital interest is perfectly fine, but the ICO's guidance is quite clearly ambiguous. But actually, the ICO's view is that communications via LinkedIn are generally going to be B2C communications, and therefore consent will be required, which was a real eye opener to us. And I'm hoping that this kind of lights a fire under everybody on this call to just think about that situation. Vicky, Dave, anything you want to chuck in? Because we've got completely different opinions in the room about, you know, what the ICO guidance actually means, because it's really quite ambiguous. I'm going to find a link to it whilst you throw in your two penneth.
For sure. I was taking the opposite side of saying, well, actually, I think the ICO's guidance, what it was indicating, is the fact that we shouldn't be taking a blanket approach to marketing through LinkedIn and assuming all marketing through LinkedIn is only caught by B2B, and therefore we don't necessarily need to consider B2C. I think the ICO's guidance was just alluding to the fact that actually some marketing materials and some marketing communications through LinkedIn may be considered as B2C communications, where you're talking to the individual. Yes, it may be a professional platform, but the individual, depending on the content and the nature of your communication, may make that marketing element B2C, because you're not talking to the individual within their capacity as an employee or an agent of the organization. You're trying to talk to that employee as an individual, as a consumer. And an example I was looking at was maybe like a recruitment agent that maybe reaches out to you on LinkedIn, for example, to talk to you about, I've got an opportunity, would you be interested, that kind of thing, versus I'm selling a range of office chairs and wondered if your organization was needing office chairs, and then targeted that communication to the facilities manager, that kind of thing. And I was trying to split the difference between the ICO's guidance, in the sense that actually we shouldn't be assuming it's one or the other. We should be coming back to probably Andrew's point about context, really, is looking at the context of the communication, looking at the purpose and the means behind that, and then actually trying to determine, are we actually taking a B2C approach or are we taking a B2B approach? Because if it is a B2C, then rules around electronic direct marketing apply. And that was my stance. But I'm more than happy to take alternative approaches to it.
I can't find it now. This is one of the key problems I've got with the ICO's website. I know it's in there and I cannot find it. Got no idea where to look for it. Unbelievably frustrating.
To my mind, you know, an individual makes their own account. Regardless of where they work, you know, they can update the account in light of, you know, what their current employment situation is and so on. But it is still the individual behind it, if that makes sense. So I guess it's just making sure that you take that into consideration. If you receive marketing, you're not receiving it, as you say, for always on behalf of the organization you work for. I don't think anyone's interested in marketing communications and in the main.
This morning we were chatting and we were saying, well, does it, what about job, approaching something about a job? Is that marketing? You know, is it promoting something? Well, interesting. But I think the ICO's guidance was that, again, you horses for courses, you know, different sites with different audiences, different intentions is going to be the key here. I'm just trying to find the link to share and I cannot find
Vicky's,
it anywhere.
Vicky's just dropped it into the chat.
I've just popped it in the chat, yeah.
Okay, so right, so that's the thing, and it's quite a long way down into it, down that page. I'm going to have a look at it.
It is, yeah. So in my opinion, I think mostly people sign up to LinkedIn for their own personal reasons, and they sign it with their own personal email address. They're not purely on there just to further the aims of the company that they work for, because you leave and then you move to a new company and you carry on with the same profile. So considering that to be B2C, it seemed more reasonable in my mind, and that you're actually marketing to the individual and therefore Pekka is engaged.
Yeah.
But you've got to read the guidance, haven't you, really, to figure out why we think it's ambiguous. I'm just trying to find where it is on this page. I know it's on here somewhere, I just can't find where it is.
I have pasted the actual term into the chat as well as the
link.
Oh,
right, okay, right.
If you look at the comment above it.
And just for those who's listening in, do you want to just read out the chat, Vicky? Because on the podcast, they might not be able to see it if they're listening.
Good point. So the ICO term says, in terms of professional networking sites, in many cases, individuals use these sites as a promotional tool and to further their careers. They are unlikely to be on the site exclusively in their business capacity, i.e. they are not on the site simply as a representative of the organisation that they work for. If an individual is using such a platform in their personal, albeit professional capacity, then sending them direct marketing messages is not considered B2B marketing. And I think that's quite clear, that last sentence is not considered to be B2B marketing.
So the question is it marketing? Is it, therefore, if it's not B2B, is it B2C marketing? You know, that was the discussion we had, wasn't it, really? But then it further goes on to say, individuals on professional networking sites may have different expectations about how their personal data is used compared to their personal use of other network and social media sites. However, this depends on the particular circumstance and context, which Dave interpreted as saying, oh, that must loosen up the bit above. And me saying, no, no, it doesn't. That's so totally separate. That's about fairness, not lawfulness. But anyway.
And this is where it's really interesting. This is why forums like this, and we have these discussions all the time internally about these points. It's really good just to kind of thrash them about and to have the freedom and the comfort to kind of try to take a different track and kind of go, well, I see it this way, someone sees that way, and have a real good kind of session at thrashing it about. And unless it's me, I just find it quite enjoyable to kind of take a different track, to stand on a kind of from a moot point and just to see what else it may tease out. So if anybody's got any thoughts and feelings, are you in line with it is B2C? Are you in line with it's not B2C? Are you in line with who cares? If you want to drop your comments into the chat, it'd be quite interesting to see what people's thoughts and feelings are on that. But like I say, it's a really interesting debate that's been going around the office recently.
But did you not reach out to the ICO to ask their opinion?
I did. Yeah, so I went on their chat and they basically just agreed with the guidance that was on document. But I was hoping that she would give a bit more background and you know, contextualise it, but she didn't. But no, they said that you know, contacting somebody with the aim of marketing via LinkedIn is classed as B2C, and therefore you need consent. And when I said to her, okay, well, fair enough, but how do you recommend that we get consent? Because, you know, asking them for consent is considered a marketing message. And she said, well, you could ring them up and ask them if they're happy for you to send them a message. And I just thought that was ludicrous.
But the guidance isn't necessarily right, is it? I mean, it's what we've got to work with. But do you remember the guidance about charities weren't able to rely on the soft opt-in? Because yeah, they weren't promoted, but what a load of old cobblers!
No,
but that's what they
purchase or something, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Well, what about Oxfam or charities with shops and charities
outlets
with restaurants? Yeah. And yeah, it's ridiculous, isn't it? So their guidance isn't necessarily right, but you never know until you're prepared to challenge it through the court. So, yes, that's basically it, isn't it?
So just following on a couple of chats, we've got 2-0 at the moment, possibly for B2C. We've got 50-50. I'll go with applying with a context. So we've maybe got one halfway in the middle. And then Andrew again says an old sage once turned it to me at a conference and said, put 4 DPOs around a table and eventually they will have an argument about a topic or a point that nobody else around them understands. So I think, yes, I will go with that option, Andrew. I think that's a very good response.
That's absolutely fabulous. What was I going to say? I've forgotten again. My head is like a sieve. Yes, but the bottom line to all this is what we're going to say. The bottom line to all this is that as a DPO in an organisation, you know, we've got to kind of make that call and advise our colleagues who then might, for commercial reasons, ignore our comments. You know, they would weigh up the chances of getting caught, the damage that would be done against the, you know, the loss of that marketing channel. And, you know, having a commercial background myself, I would probably say, fine, you know, the risks, you know.
But is it not more about justifying the stance that you come to from trying to interpret their interpretation? And at least you'd like to think if you got it wrong, the ICO or whoever looking at that would say, well, I can see your interpretation. I can see where you're going with it, but it's a wrong interpretation, as opposed to just looking like you willfully ignored guidance.
I think that's right. It's that defensible position again. Yeah. If you did get called in and you would be saying, well, I spoke to David Holmes and he told me that it was definitely B2B. Because it was great the way you kind of highlighted the bits, and when I read your highlighted bits on that, I thought, yeah, I can see that you're emphasizing the bits to strengthen your argument, and I can see that, yeah, but I still disagree. Anyway, sorry, we've nearly run out of time. We only spoke about two things today, SARS and this, but we thought it was interesting just kind of to throw this in. I mean, a lot of people don't come across a pecker in their work, but yeah, soapbox over, quite right. But it just made us, you know, giggle a little bit that the guidance, we couldn't make sense of it. And there was 4 or 5 of us kicking it around the table.
For sure.
Right. What else did you want to talk about, Dave? GPT?
Yeah, there's a lot of chat around ChatGPT at the moment, and that kind of thing, and it makes you wonder whether where it's all going, and it's possibly one for another time, because we are running quite close to the time for the session. But it's maybe one that we need to.
Are you going to join us next week?
I will be. Yeah, I'll be listening in. But there'll be with ChatGPT, they've got the obvious things. I know you sent a link, Phil, and I do intend to read it, but it leads you to think things around plagiarism, whether there's ethics if a bot is writing your homework for you, that kind of thing. Do you acknowledge that the computer's put it together, or do you kind of just put your own name on it? Does it lead to things like issues around copyright and so on and so forth? What about accuracy behind where the information's coming from, what it's drawing on and things? But I certainly know it's got a lot of traction, and I certainly got a lot of chat around ChatGPT, shall we say. So it's certainly an interesting one, really, to kind of get heads around what that means. My fear is possibly in a few years' time, well, a benefit in a few years' time is you might be able to talk to it, tell it what your processing operations are, and it might be able to return a ROPA for you relatively quickly. I'd like to think there's some benefits for DP in it, but I'd also like to think it wasn't intelligent enough to replace the DPO and have the conversations that we have regularly on these sessions. Otherwise, next time you're tuning in, you'll just be listening to a load of chatbots talking to each other.
Yes. Now, I would like to thank David Holmes for being our most excellent colleague for the last few years. Dave, and I'll miss your counsel. You know, you've been great on these sessions, you know, great around in the business, great in the office, you know, a fabulous colleague, and, you know, good luck in your new role. Thank you for everything you've done with us.
No, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you so much. Thank you. Think everyone can agree.
I'm not going far. I'll still be around.
Your support and experience is invaluable.
I'll be hollering from the sidelines on the chat within the GDPR radio sessions.
Yeah, we'll be getting you to
you'll be muted and giving us a set of aggro.
The soapbox is not dead.
Oh, absolutely not. No, we've got to keep the soapbox alive. You'll have to just give me 5 minutes to have a rant about something, then you can mute me.
So I think this week was meant to be GDPR radio, isn't it? Yes. So next week we're meant to be doing SARS, I believe. And then after that, we've got another revisitation of the Housing Reform Bill in two weeks on the 3rd of March. That's for our, particularly for our housing colleagues. But, you know, as you know, we do ramble and go off piece as well. And so it could be interesting for everybody. I think we've probably run out of time, so Jasmine, are you going to close up, or Dave, you want to close up for your last time?
Go on, Dave, take the honour.
I wasn't expecting to come up so quickly, but let's just say we've run out of time again. Let's go through the usual chat that if you give us long enough, we'll talk all afternoon around topics and subjects. And we'd like to thank you for joining. Thank you to those who have taken part. It's been a really, really engaging session with all of the comments and all of those who are muted and joined in. And we would like to encourage more of you to do so. It's a community that we're trying to build, and it's an area where we feel it should be a safe space for people to raise questions and queries and to take appropriate advice and guidance from each other, and not necessarily just from ourselves. So do keep listening in, and I'll certainly be joining in regularly where I can, and listening in too, to still give my two pennies worth, although it may only be worth a penny in future editions, not two pennies. So I'll still be listening in. But thank you very much for joining in. As always, we're here for you guys. It's an environment and a community that we're building for you, and without you guys, we wouldn't be what we're doing, and it wouldn't be as big as and growing as it is. So thank you on behalf of me and DPP to you guys who regularly listen in. But for now, we'll call it there. Have a great weekend, and we'll see you next week with the session on SARS. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dave.
Thank you. Everyone. Thank you, Jasmine.
Have a good weekend.
Thank you.
Thanks, bye. Yep.
Take care, everybody.
Bye.